Hello, and welcome to the OMFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about globalization cycles and free trade. This is Pierre Ortlieb from London, and today we'll be speaking to Harold James, who is the Claude and Laura Kelly Professor in European Studies, a Professor of History and International Affairs at Princeton University, as well as Bob Koopman, who is the Chief Economist at the WTO. Welcome. So I thought we'd kick things off today by talking about globalization cycles, by which I mean parallels between our current era of globalization as well as previous ones that have taken place, for instance, in the late 19th century and early 20th century. So when we think about globalization now, I know, Harold, in your book, you make the case that our current era of globalization is characterized primarily by financial flows, and that this is truly the era of financial globalization as opposed to previous epochs. So what exactly are the parallels that you would draw between this and previous phases of globalization?
I've always looked at globalization as being about the movement of many, many different factors of production. So it's about the movement of goods and trade, of course, but it's also about the movement of people. It's about the movement of capital. It's about the movement of ideas. And my big story in that book, I published one book on globalization in the early 2000s and then a kind of update of it in 2009, is that we shouldn't think of globalization as simply being a one-way inexorable process that necessarily goes in one direction. But in the past, there have been periods of more integration, and then there have been reversals of that integration. And I think it's important to say that the movements of capital go alongside the movements of goods and the movements of people. To some extent, they can sometimes be substitutes for each other, but they're associated. And so a kickback against one, a pushback against one, often leads to a pushback in other areas of civilization. And I looked at the Great Depression then as the era in which the world fell apart in the late 1920s and early 1930s. And I think what was striking about that, and what I really wanted to make is the major point of the argument, was that the Great Depression was not primarily caused by trade protectionism. The trade protectionism came later as a response to the big contagious financial crises in the summer of 1931. And so, you know, when we're thinking about today, there's obviously a lot of discussion about whether we're in an era of new protectionism. We're waiting for the 1st of March and to see whether the United States is going to raise the tariffs on Chinese products. We may have tariffs on automobiles from Europe. But I think that's, in a way, a little bit of a distraction from this fundamental issue. I think the pushback today is also on migration issues and in terms of capital market integration.
That's right. And Bob, could we get your insight on this? So what do you make of this current cycle of globalization? And could you perhaps emphasize, for instance, the WTO's role in sustaining perhaps this phase of globalization?
Sure, Pierre. Well, I think one of the things that the WTO has done rather well was prevent a rather big outbreak in protectionism with the binding tariffs and WTO commitments and transparency. So after the great financial crisis, you did not see the kinds of protectionist, as Harold was saying, the kinds of protectionist measures that came about with Smoot-Hawley and the responses to Smoot-Hawley and the Great Depression. So I think the WTO in many ways worked very well. I do agree with Harold that the protectionism of the 20s and 30s didn't cause the Great Depression. The Great Depression was much more of a financial shock and bad monetary and fiscal policies following it. When we think about what's happening now in terms of the current tariffs, I think it's important to realize that U.S.-China trade makes up about 3% of global trade. So these tariffs and the retaliation of tariffs that we see is covering a relatively small share of total trade. If you get to auto tariffs and auto parts, you start getting to about 8% of global trade, and that's a much bigger number, so you could see bigger effects there. Of course, we're concerned about these tariffs, but I don't think you can expect these tariffs to cause themselves to contribute to a global slowdown. Maybe on the margin, very small, maybe 0.2 of global GDP. The problem is if they start to affect the financial sectors and if they start to affect investment, their consumer behavior, because of uncertainty, so firms are worried about their supply chains, they're worried about making investments, then you see much bigger effects on global GDP.
What do you think the likelihood of that effect is, considering that we do already live in an economic age characterized by uncertainty, what with rates rising around the world? Is that something that you peg as quite likely to happen, that trade tariffs will have an impact on things like investment and consumer demand?
So I would say that the tariffs themselves have minor impact on those things. It's much more the uncertainty that comes about from them. And we are watching very closely, along with our counterpart institutions, the IMF and the World Bank and others, what's happening to investment. We're very concerned that it's weakening. Consumption growth has been relatively strong, particularly in the United States, but we see Europe weakening. We see China. Consumer behavior is, you know, consumers seem to be responding to the uncertainty. Chinese investment seems to be a bit weak. That seems to be affecting exports from Germany. So these things are connected and we're concerned. And what we see right now is some of the recovery that had started to occur 2017, 2018 dissipating. So we expect weaker growth as a result, but nothing right now indicates a global recession as a result of these trade actions.
Thank you. I like that you mentioned China, because I would love to hear your insight on what you make of the weakening domestic demand in China, or rather the rising domestic demand in China. I think what we've seen in the last couple of years is a kind of rebalancing of the Chinese economy away from export-led growth towards greater domestic consumer demand. What do you make of that ongoing shift and its potential success?
Well, first of all, I would never describe China as export-led. China's been investment-led, and the rebalancing is much more about being less investment-led and more consumption-led. It has used exports to tap into demand in other countries to get returns on that investment, but returns on that investment have been declining rapidly, and so China does need to rebalance. I agree it has been, and that's very important, and we hope that that's sustained. It is concerning that with all the uncertainty as a result of the trade relationship between the U.S. and China, that Chinese consumers are getting nervous. There's been a stock market fall in China. Chinese firms are worried about both domestic and foreign investment. So back to Harold's discussions about financial flows. I think the worst thing that could happen right now is for a significant China slowdown, driven by slowdown in Chinese consumption as a result of this uncertainty. It would slow the rebalancing that we've been observing.
Sticking with China, but shifting gears slightly, Harold, I wanted to get your take on the factors that sustain globalization. So in the late 19th century, dominant theory is that Britain was playing the role of a kind of hegemon in providing the public good of free trade by taking on a domestic burden and sort of playing that role of a unipolar global power. And that was the mechanism through which it was able to open up markets around the world. And obviously the U.S. has played a similar role over the past, well, anywhere really between 30 years and 70 years. And a lot of people have argued that China has the potential to play that role in the coming century. What do you make of this argument that you need a kind of hegemonic power to sustain globalization, a power that's willing to bear the domestic burden of free and open global trade?
It's a very important part of the explanation of the Great Depression. It was pushed particularly by the great economist, economic historian, Charles Kindlebecker. And the point was that the UK was unable to play this stabilizing role and the United States was unwilling to do that in the early 1930s. And in that sense, I think it's an interesting discussion, really, in the aftermath of the 2007-2008 financial crisis. In fact, in that instance, China already was playing with other emerging markets, but China played an enormous role in providing demand that really got the world to avoid a Great Depression. So, yes, I think the institutional framework, and we talked about that already, was very important to have the WTO and the Fund and the World Bank. But the fact that China had this big 4 trillion renminbi stimulus program, that really was a part of bringing the world out. And what China's done since then, and particularly, I think, much more aggressively under Xi Jinping, is to actually promote a different kind of vision of globalization. So in part, a flagship program of this is this One Belt, One Road approach. And the striking thing about that, I think, is the belt part of it. Because globalization in the 19th century and in the early 20th century, and also the globalization that we experienced recently, was really primarily driven, if you think about it, by cities on the sea, the maritime globalization. And the Chinese effort is to push a land-based globalization as well, and in particular the land route across the Eurasian landmass and directed. And for me, there are fascinating parallels there with the world before 1914, because Germany had exactly that vision of a land-based globalization that was different to the mercantile financial globalization of the British. And Germany was pushing the infrastructure, the big Berlin to Baghdad railroad, so that's the equivalent really of the Chinese project. And in part, explicitly, I think, as a challenge to the hegemon. And so, you know, what that parallel tells you is that we're really living in a world where there's much more geopolitical uncertainty. And I think if you think of the major risks of the moment, they're not primarily economic, but they lie in the sphere of geopolitics. They're where the interests of the great powers clash. And that reminds me very much of the world before 1914.
I think you're right, but I also think a lot of commentators would say that that's slightly disconcerting parallel, considering how the pre-1914 era of globalization ultimately ended, which was with the outbreak of the First World War, much to the surprise of a lot of commentators, including Norman Angell, who both of you may have heard of, who infamously said on the eve of the outbreak of the First World War that commerce, du commerce, had made military conflict almost impossible. So just looking back at that moment, what is it about the great powers and the conflict between them that allowed war to break out despite globalization, despite their commercial ties? Is that something you could elaborate on?
I think it's right that the 1914 analogy has become really quite a current trope. And a couple of years ago in Davos, the Japanese prime minister raised that specifically. Mr. Juncker in the European Commission has been constantly worrying about the parallels to the world before 1914 in the European setting. And the problem is that, in fact, in 1914, in the summer of 1914, some people clearly wanted a war, but others didn't really want the war, but got trapped in a logic that impelled them into the war. And right at the end, the Kaiser, who was one of the most aggressive pushers of militarism in Germany, tries to say, let's have a negotiation. I know I can deal with the Tsar of Russia, who's after all related to him, he's his cousin. We can talk it over, we can get over. But by that stage, there's too much in motion. There's too much of an automatic logic. And, you know, if you think of big decisions at the moment, like the debate about how, what sort of Brexit is taking place, or what kind of trade measures are going to be taken between the United States and China, there's already a logic in those measures that makes it sometimes very, very difficult to stand back, and you get trapped into something that nobody really wants. That's, for me, the tragedy of history, and that's a tragedy that can, I think, repeat itself.
That's right, and I like that point about the sort of almost the inevitability of history sometimes and the way it almost drives itself forward. And that brings me to a slightly different point that I wanted to raise as well, which is the role of firms, especially highly concentrated, very powerful firms in this current era of globalization. And I think one of the major differences that we see between our current era and previous phases of globalization is in the role that firms play and the role that value added between firms and down and up the supply chain plays in global economic ties. And so, Bob, I was wondering if perhaps you could elaborate on this. So firms obviously play a very important role in this, especially highly concentrated firms. What exactly is the direction in which this has gone? Because I think you would think that the competition from globalization would cause more firms to sort of spring up around the world, but rather what it's kind of led to is, in fact, these so-called superstar firms who do have this ability to trade up and down the supply chain. What's the direction of that process? Is it concentration that leads to an ability to globalize, or is it globalization that has led to concentration?
Well, here I think we have an endogeneity there. I think both things are working at the same time. It's very difficult to figure out causality. But I think an important element here is to keep in mind that multinationals these days, I think, had a significant influence on the political economy of trade. It used to be that one could say that trade agreements were often negotiated with countries representing their commercial interests, particularly their export interests, trying to get market access and trading that off against import competing firms who are more protectionist. Well, multinationals don't necessarily have that alignment in terms of interest with any particular national government. And the new digital technologies out there, and I think this is an important difference from past globalizations with the new rapid technological change and innovation around information technology. It's allowed these firms to manage these supply chains. It also allows them, along with a network of trade and investment agreements, to have a comparative advantage in aligning their production processes to make the most out of each of these agreements. So it's not any particular country that they're looking for to lead the way. I think they feel like they can operate in this global environment. They can localize if that's where the political and economic pressures are, or they can fragment if that's the way they see the political and economic pressures working out. I think that makes it difficult for countries to come and negotiate broad trade agreements when there doesn't seem to be the same alignment of national interest in trading off both exporters against import interests. And this technology really facilitates this. And earlier when Harold was talking about goods, people, capital, and ideas, I think this digital technology is one of these resources, and data in particular is one of these resources. You used to think about countries trying to secure their access to particular resources. These technologies do require physical resources of some kind, and it's different than, say, oil in the past. But it's not clear that it's easy for governments to stop the flow of data, and it's not clear how governments are going to manage the flow of this very important resource that underpins these multinationals' operations. Yesterday in Davos, I think there was an announcement that there would be some discussions among WTO members trying to come up with an e-commerce agreement, digital economy-based agreement, and I think those discussions are very important. Because if we can get rules that help firms understand how governments are going to regulate this kind of resource flow, it could help stabilize the kinds of pressures we see arising from this latest phase of globalization and technological change.
I think, Bob, yes, you're absolutely right. This is a very new development. But there's a security linkage of the use of information technology that I think is quite crucial. And, you know, in that respect, there's a perception all over the world. If you think, yes, I mean, Google is clearly an international company, and it may be based for many purposes in Ireland for tax reasons or in the Netherlands, but it's seen as part of the United States and part of United States soft power. And the impetus in China to build up an alternative systematically to all the US companies, the story of having Baidu as a kind of parallel, is something that I think is really quite significant in that sense. There's still a tie of these companies to a security interest. One of the big discussions is why we don't have something like this in Europe, why there's no equivalent. There's no European version of Google or no European version of Amazon or no European Facebook. And the sense is that Europe is left a bit behind, whereas China or Russia really want to have their alternatives. And in a world which thinks more in security terms, they're going to push those alternatives and make for difficulties in having an internationalization, a globalization of IT and data provision. I think you're absolutely right about the technology of the future, about data being the basis of future developments. But we treat data privacy in different ways in the United States to the way that Europeans think about it, and still different to the way that Chinese people think about it. There's a greater willingness there, I think, to trade privacy for advantages. And Europeans take a different point in that trade-off, and that gives a potential, an enormous potential in terms of future power to a Chinese vision. I think this is what also yesterday in Davos, George Soros was reflecting on, wondering about, warning about, that there's a kind of securitization of the use of data, which is deeply, deeply worrying.
That's a very good point. And one of the interesting things is trying to see these countries come together and discuss the challenges both around the security aspect, the national security aspect, but also the individual privacy aspect. And the Japanese in their G20 presidency, as part of also this e-commerce initiative, they have this thing that they call data free flow with trust, which could be the cusp of a negotiation among the major players here to see if they can find agreement. Harold, I'm not sure they will, and I think you identify some very, very important stresses amongst the major players with this new technology. But if they can come together and discuss their differences and find a way to reach some common ground while allowing for some variation in the models, it could help release some of these pressures that are building. But yeah, I do agree there are tensions and concerns in this area.
I think, Bob, you're absolutely right, and we really need the institutional framework within which these negotiations can take place. So it's really critical to have the organizations have the international forums where these issues can be played out.
It's not clear what the forums are, by the way. WTO is one, but this technology affects so many different aspects of life and commerce that I think it's up to folks like the G20 or folks at the UN to figure out a way to have these conversations and bring these aspects together.
All right. I think that's a good note to close on, actually. Slightly optimistic, which is nice. Thank you, Bob, for your input. Thank you, Harold, as well. Look out for next week's OMFIFT podcast. This will be available on our channel on Tuesday, so you can download it once it has been broadcast or subscribe to our channel. If you've enjoyed the program, then please do leave us a review.